Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Tracy Fessenden. Fessenden is a Steve and Margaret Forster professor in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. She is the author of many scholarly articles, as well as two books, Culture and Redemption, Religion, the Secular and American Literature, and her most recent, and what we'll be discussing on today's show, Religion Around Billie Holiday. It was published by Pennsylvania State University Press in April 2018. And I'm speaking to Tracy Fessenden by phone from her home in Arizona. Tracy Fessenden, thanks for joining us. Now, we all know about Billie Holiday's struggles with drugs and her unique and gorgeous voice, but not a lot has been written about the influence of Catholicism and religion in her career and her person. To tell us a little bit about these influences.
Thank you, Tish. I'm delighted to be talking with you. And one of my goals in the book is to broaden our sense of the relationship between religion and jazz, religion and American music more generally. I think many of us are aware that the Black Baptist Church contributed a great deal to American sound through the gospel train route, and then also in forming a number of artists who went on to become blues singers, sometimes in opposition to religious backgrounds that they rejected. What I'm interested in this book, broadly, is in the ways in which other religious traditions fed into American sound, Jewish songwriting, synagogue chant, liturgical chant. In the specific case of Billie Holiday, I'm very interested in how she was formed as a young woman who was raised in part in a Catholic convent, the House of the Good Shepherd for Colored Girls in Baltimore, as it was known then, where she was sent twice, once at age 10, another time at age 11, for care and education by the Good Shepherd sisters who ran the House of the Good Shepherd. So I'm very interested in looking at that particular period in Billie Holiday's life and thinking about the ways in which it shaped her both musically and otherwise as part of a broader picture of religion and Billie Holiday's absolutely distinctive, incredible sound.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I would never have thought that religion was a huge influence. You know, we only hear about her troubles and her fights with people, and so that's really interesting. So she was in this Catholic landscape from about the age of 9 or 10. Tell us how you think it did influence her. I know she learned how to sing.
Yes, that in some ways has been the most controversial claim that I advance in this book, that she learned to sing in large part on the streets in Baltimore. She was very much in demand in good time houses during Prohibition. And imagine this very, very young girl, 11 years old, 12 years old, who was already well known in many of the speakeasies as a singer. And so that was part of her musical formation, certainly. But as a pupil, first in a Catholic kindergarten where she stayed for a couple of years, then came out and bounced around in and out of public schools before going to the Good Shepherd, she, at both the Catholic school, the St. Francis Academy for Colored Girls, as it was known, and then the House of the Good Shepherd for Colored Girls, she sang a Catholic Mass every day. She sang the parts assigned to choirs in the Book of Gregorian Chant that was in use at that time. So that, I am really quite certain, was a deeply formative influence, and it surprises me how readily biographers and musicologists overlook that part of her training. You know, we talk about Charlie Parker in the woodshed playing scales, that was really what made Charlie Parker his decision to retreat and practice for a while and just do scales, as he said, for quite a long time. I think singing a Mass every day went as much to Billie Holiday's distinctive sound as that kind of apprenticeship could have for Charlie Parker.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people are just afraid to tackle religion. They're afraid it'll bring in all kinds of controversy, and yeah,
which it does. Yes, with good reason. We're skittish about that because it brings in enormous controversy. You know, when I talk about Billie Holiday's Catholic formation, some readers assume that I am entirely in admiration of these the figures in her life who brought her into this setting. But in fact, it was really a place where girls were sent who would otherwise today be in our criminal justice system. The House of the Good Shepherd survived until very, very recently, just this year, as a juvenile detention facility. So that's really what it was. It wasn't necessarily the case that she was given the kind of care, the kind of generative, loving nurture that we would want for all of our children. And, of course, there were many horror stories that passed among the inmates in the House of the Good Shepherd, as they were known. They were known as inmates. So this was not a necessarily heartwarming chapter in her life, but I think it was certainly a formative one.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, this whole era was absolutely filled with racism and trouble for women and, and danger. And you know what interests me that you talk about in your book about how black music was referred to as race records.
Yes.
To tell us a little bit about the racism and what Billy had to do to actually overcome some of this.
Oh, my goodness. I think, first of all, we're very drawn to the vocabulary of overcoming. I think we all have Mahalia Jackson singing "We Shall Overcome" somewhere in the back of our minds.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of black artists and black women and men and kids in generally, overcoming was not part of the... It may have been an aspirational goal, but it wasn't part of their day-to-day experience because it was relentless. The racism was relentless. So I see Billie Holiday navigating these currents very shrewdly, very skillfully, but overcoming, I'm not quite ready to use that word because it suggests that these forms of institutional and structural racism were easily dissolved, or that most of us could have overcome them, and I just don't think that that's the case. So, yes, she was put into the criminal justice system, and the House of the Good Shepherd was a part of that in 1920s Baltimore. Her mother was also an inmate in the House of the Good Shepherd for about 5 or 6 years, and gave birth to Eleonora, her daughter, who became Billie Holiday shortly after her release. When I've gone back through the records, and this is just one minor example of how this system worked, when I've gone back through the records of what a young girl or woman might have been sentenced for, in some cases, a grand jury would have authorized money to go to the House of Good Shepherd to build new beds, and so these beds had to be filled to justify the expense. So it looks as though at the time Sadie, Billie Holiday's mother, was sent to the House of the Good Shepherd, she might have been caught up in this roundup of girls who were just at the movies instead of being in school on a particular day.
Wow.
So, that's just one small example of what black girls faced in Baltimore in the teens and 20s. Of course, Billie Holiday was made to wait by the toilets between sets when she played with Artie Shaw's band in the Lincoln Hotel. She was one of the only African-American singers to tour with a white band, Artie Shaw's band, in 1938. And when they bravely toured the South, of course, she, and parts of the Midwest and the North as well, she was not allowed to stay in a hotel. She was not allowed to use bathroom facilities. She was not allowed to eat in restaurants with the band.
Yeah.
And that's day-to-day, amazing. Yes, just the erosion.
And
of
she couldn't
spirit.
Drink in the bars either, right? She wasn't allowed to even
often
get a drink.
That was the case. Yes. If she sat at the bar, she was asked to leave, even if she was headlining that set. And, of course, that's, the history of African-American entertainment in New York is rife with those kinds of stories. The Cotton Club, for example, had very strict rules for its choreens, as they were called, the women who sang and danced, enormously talented women who had to also be beautiful and light-skinned in order to be a part of that company. But they were forbidden to drink at the bar and forbidden to mix with the patrons who came up from all parts of New York to see them. And so very, it was an entertainment system that really relied on various forms of racism, from exoticism and primitivism to the kinds of, imposition of segregation that were routinely enforced legally and extra-legally. So, yes, that was the system that she negotiated and did so at great cost to her spirit and life.
And thank God she did. God, her music is so amazing. It's so much a part of our American history and culture.
Now, and a part of our soundtrack. I can go into a Starbucks with my teenage kids, and they hear Billie Holiday, and they think this is this is new. This is the music that that we all love right now, and they're not wrong. I can't think of another artist from the 30s and 40s that we would make that kind of judgment about. I think she's the only one whose sound stays constantly fresh, constantly new throughout the 20th century, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about Strange Fruit before we play a little clip from it. It was the first commercial song that covered lynching. Tell us a bit more.
Yes, you know, there were oblique references to lynching in some blues songs, but you're right that this was the first song that was released into mass distribution. There was a controversy about recording it. John Hammond, who was Billie Holiday's producer, a very complex figure, he was already rich, but he made his name by advancing black artists and also exploiting them terribly. So that's a whole other story. He was not interested in recording Strange Fruit. He thought that it was too commercial. Not commercial enough and too controversial. And so he arranged for Billie Holiday to record this on a different label. She made it her trademark song. She tended to close sets with it throughout her career. Sometimes she said it was just too much for her. She couldn't bear it, and so she did. She kept it off the song list for a particular venue. But throughout her career, she frequently closed her sets with Strange Fruit. And it is, you know, of course, all of your listeners who know it, it's a searing witness to lynching. It looks directly at the crime, looks directly into the face, the wounded, mangled body of the lynched person, and sings from that place of witness. So it is extraordinary, as much today as ever, certainly as much today as ever.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tracy Fessenden, and we're talking about her book, Religion Around Billie Holiday. And we're getting ready to, let's listen to a cut from Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
So let's talk about the fact that Holiday did not want to be called a blues singer, but a jazz singer. So tell us, what was the difference in her mind?
You know, I think the difference in her mind was that blues was a form, it was a genre, and she could certainly sing blues. She was an incredibly gifted blues singer, but she was also a great singer of show tunes, of art songs, of, you know, European cabaret-type songs. And so blues singer, she rightly, I would say, inferred, was a label like Race Records. It was a label that was designed to sort of class all African-American singers together in one group. And she resisted that imposition of a label that would have dismissed her as simply an African-American singer. But she wasn't very successful in shedding that label. It was used to describe her, certainly up until her death, and most of her obituaries describe her as a blues singer.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's logical that they would. Now, what astonishes many of us is how Holiday was able to record such a volume of great work while struggling with heroin addiction, prison sentences. Tell us about that. Did somebody push her, or was this all on her initiative to actually get out and do creative work?
You know, Tish, that is such a great question, and it's one that few people really consider. My own reading is that singing for her was, you know, it was a kind of spiritual practice, and I don't mean to imply that it was religious in any sense, but it was what kept her spirit alive. It was what kept her in the world as the genius she was. When she was in the courts, when she was, you know, living in her addiction, when she was dealing with, you know, racist concert promoters and producers and hotel managers, she was not living in her genius. And I think when she sang, she was. And so my sense, listening to her and knowing what we do about her life, is that that was the space where she was Billie Holiday, when she was most herself. And so it was part of her, it was part of how she stayed alive. You know, in the last year of her life, she ate very little. She lived on gin and 7-Up for the most part. So she was shrugging off her embodied life. But she never stopped recording, and she was still at the very, very end. The last two records, your listeners might be aware, are hard for some of us to listen to, because if we know how her health was at that moment, we can hear it in the certainly in the grain of her voice, in the difficulty she had with some of the notes. But she didn't stop. She was just as much a perfectionist in those last recording sessions as she had been at any time in her career. You know, accompanists were terrified of her in many cases, because she was a very, very demanding artist. And if she didn't like the way you sounded, if she didn't like the note you played, you would hear about it. And so she was very demanding of herself and of those who played with her.
She recorded from 1933 to 1959, which is remarkable. So
yes.
Another thing I want to talk about is, a lot of people aren't aware of her connections with writers like Jack Kerouac, Langston Hughes, Elizabeth Bishop. Ted, tell us a little bit about that.
You know, that I think that is genius recognizing genius. I don't know, I can't think offhand of other musical artists who had that devoted a following among our literary artists. I think it was just a recognition, a mutual recognition. Kerouac adored her. He wrote her into On the Road. She has a bit part in On the Road. He wanted to write a book about her, and his friend John Cleland Holmes beat him to it, but he wanted to base a novel on Billie Holiday and Lester Young's relationship. And he names one of his love interests Billie in one of the last novels he writes, Big Sur. Elizabeth Bishop had a very ambivalent relationship with Holiday, because Elizabeth Bishop's lover, Louise Crane, fell madly in love with Billie Holiday. And, you know, that was a bit of a you know, difficult situation for Elizabeth Bishop and Louise Crane. Holiday seems to have benefited from it, because Louise Crane became a very important financial patron of hers. And of course, Langston Hughes, his biographer says he spent, you know, in the last years of his life listening to God Bless the Child each night on the same record before he fell asleep. So I think just as musical artists tend to listen to a lot of Billie Holiday, Count Basie said when she was 23, 24, when she was touring, not even, my goodness, she was 22 when she started touring with Count Basie, and he said that they would listen to her records on tour, the band would listen to her records. So I think people who are that good at whatever their form of expression is can recognize in Billie Holiday something to aspire to, and
absolutely
bring her into their worlds.
But let's talk a little bit about God Bless the Child. We're gonna share an excerpt pretty soon, and I know she co-wrote this, so this is really stamped into our minds that it's her song.
Yes, very much so. The sheet music gives songwriting credit to Billie Holiday and Arthur Herzog, who was a Tin Pan Alley stalwart, composed a lot of numbers from that period, and it is a fascinating song. You know, when I told people that I was writing a book about religion and Billie Holiday, a lot of them said, "Oh, God Bless the Child. That's the religious song."
Yeah.
And you know, it's really she could, you know, because most of the African American women artists that we associate from this period were raised in a gospel tradition. They were raised in a Black Protestant tradition. She, in the same way that she was classified as a blues singer, she was classified by many people and in many people's minds as someone who would be likewise steeped in that gospel tradition. So what I hear in God Bless the Child, she's sort of playing with that tradition a little bit. She calls the song a swing spiritual, but as you know, it's not really a spiritual. It doesn't really swing. It doesn't have any basis in a biblical text, which she claims it does, or at least the sheet music claims it does. There's a possible parallel in the parable of the talents. But in any case, it was her riff on what people expected, I think, from an African-American woman singer. And you know, the story that she tells about God Bless the Child is that she wanted money from her mom when she lived with her mother, Sadie, in Harlem. Sadie ran an after-hours club, sort of restaurant slash a good time house, and this was financed by, in large part, by Louise Crane, the wealthy heiress who had fallen in love with Billie Holiday. So Billie Holiday said she was taking money from her mother's, from the till of this good time house, and her mother said, no, you know, leave that. And so she said, well, God bless the child who's got his own, meaning I do have my own. You know, thank goodness I'm not relying on this. Mm-hmm. And that became the basis for this song, as she tells it. And so it's really, it's very interesting to me how it has taken on a life of its own in musical history and cultural history. Many people do consider it a very religious song. It's part of the, you know, the gospel repertoire of many gospel choirs throughout the world. Some people do find a deeply spiritual meaning in this song. But my sense is that for a holiday, it really was just a riff on expectations that were imposed on her as an African-American woman singer, that she would have this gospel tradition. And so she was saying, yes, I can play with this gospel tradition all I want, and I can make a memorable song from it, but this really isn't my, you know, this isn't the world in which I move.
Let's listen to a bit of it. You know, I think it's really interesting that you called it slyly subversive spiritual.
Yes, yes.
That sort of sums it up in a good way, I think. I'm sure Billy loved the word submissive, probably.
Well, yeah, some will disagree, but yes, I you know, she had just been kicked out of a big Carnegie Hall concert called From Spirituals to Swing. It was a John Hammond production, and he just thought that Billie Holiday was he couldn't control her was the takeaway. So she turned around and recorded this song that she called a swing spiritual, sort of saying, you know, if they had Twitter then, we'd call it trolling, right? She took the name of this concert and turned it into something that was distinctly her own, and which people remember, I think, much more than they remember the Spirituals to Swing concert, as important as that was.
Well, let's talk about the 1956 bio, Lady Sings the Blues, real quickly. What was the reaction? How did that even come about? I can't believe she concentrated long enough to be able to have somebody write something like this.
Well, she had already certainly a critical following, and she also had a kind of sensationalized or sensational reputation, and this was made for her by many sources. The drug czar who was after her whole adult life, Harry Anslinger, longest-serving drug commissioner and first and longest-serving in the U.S. government, really liked the idea of going after celebrities, and he sort of stoked this image of Billie Holiday as a glamorous, gorgeous tormented
drug addict, right?
Junkie.
Yeah.
Which was a familiar image from True Confessions type magazines, police magazines. So he wanted her to be that, and many people looked to her to be that person. Now, when it came time to write her autobiography, which the publisher recognized that this would sell, right? This would be a popular book. Ethel Waters' autobiography had just been a very, very successful book on the same press. So the man who was asked to come in and write the book with her, for her, William Dufty, was a very talented hack. He was very he loved Billie Holiday. He loved her music. He was very attuned to her. He said they were both Irish Catholics, so they got along on that level.
That's great.
he began asking her questions about confession, the sacrament of confession. He said, when did you start lying in the confessional? That was his first question to open up their conversation about her autobiography. She said, I've been asked all kinds of things, and no one has ever asked me that. So they sort of related on that level. And he was trying to thread a needle, I think, between a biography that would be uplifting, as Ethel Waters had been, her biography had been very uplifting. You know, she had risen up from a very difficult childhood. Same story, lots of drug addiction, lots of trouble with the law. He wanted to do that kind of uplifting story, but he also wanted to appeal to those who were interested in Billie Holiday, the beautiful junkie, you know, Billie Holiday, the tormented soul. And so he tried to tell both stories at once. You know, if you read Billie Holiday's stuff, you'll see that there's a lot of controversy about that book, and the consensus is that it was all made up. Well, some of it was made up, but some of it, I think, is quite accurate. I met with the son of William Duffy, Bevan Duffy, who is the BART commissioner in San Francisco, an absolutely lovely guy, very generous in sharing stories with me and materials from his father's relationship with Billie Holiday. And he said, yeah, Billie Holiday sat at their table and she talked and his father typed. And so many of the stories do come from her. Now, she made up many stories about her life that don't check out perfectly.
Well, that's perfectly normal, right?
Of course. So I approach it as, you know, a sort of document that gives us a window onto the way Billie Holiday thought of herself, the way others thought of her, and the way she negotiated those expectations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a fascinating book. I read it many, many years ago when I was first being introduced to Billie Holiday's music.
Yes.
So. It fascinated me. And, you know, that thing we were talking about early on, I just assumed she was just a junkie and a sad person in a racist culture. You know, I didn't really take in her whole, I mean, that she was writing songs and, you know, performing and recording and, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And so disciplined. And, you know, if you saw the movie version of Lady Sings the Blues.
Oh, yes, with Diana Ross. Yep.
You would have that impression, you know, confirmed and redoubled that here she was, just this lost soul who was lost to heroin, because of course that was the image that people wanted, and she, Billie Holiday herself, was not above playing to that expectation, but she was also so much more than that. You know, I'm hearing that there is a new biopic in the way, in the works, a new movie of Billie Holiday's life. That Susan Laurie Parks, the MacArthur Award-winning playwright, has a hand in. So that will be marvelous. I'm very, very excited to think about what that might be.
Oh, God, that sounds great. Yes, her life needs to continue to be part of our culture for sure.
Yes, yes.
Can you give some contact information, how people can get in touch?
Oh, you know, I'm in the process of putting together a website. I'm a little bit backwards about how I'm approaching this. However, I'm easy to find at Arizona State University. I'm the director of a school here. So if you look for my name, Tracy Fessenden, you'll see my contact information. And you'll also see a lot of information about the book, which will eventually be gathered in one place very soon. But I'm not hard to find. And I would love to hear from people who have Billie Holiday stories or Billie Holiday memories, favorite Billie Holiday songs or experiences. I would just love to be in conversation.
Well, Tracy Fessenden, this has been a great conversation. And as you know, Billie Holiday is so important to all of us, I think.
Yes.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Tish, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.